and technological pursuit.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today we're coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. And we've got a show today I've been looking forward to for a long time. We are now, I think, in the midst of a veritable golden age of books about the current administration and some of its tendencies. We've had some of the authors on this show. We'll have more in the future on this program. People like Paul Krugman, Michael Moore have written books, Al Franken, Molly Ivins. But today we have as our guest the author of a best-selling new book, a relatively new book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. And the author is David Korn, the Washington editor of The Nation magazine and a contributor to the Fox News Channel. Korn's a well-known political journalist, one of the best-known in the country. And this book, I think, is a book that anyone interested in contemporary politics would be interested in reading. And it's my great pleasure today to welcome David Korn to Media Matters.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I gather you're at the Fox News Channel right now, bunkered down. Is that right?
Well, as we speak, I am sitting in the conference room of the Fox News Bureau in Washington, D.C., gazing at a majestic view of both the Capitol and Union Station.
Is it a clear, sunny day there, I hope?
Yes, although the paranoia has just gone up a bit because they just raised the security, the terror alert to high. Tom Ridge just finished up a press conference, so that's made things in the Bureau a little bit busier this afternoon.
Well, I guess we can all rest a lot easier out here in the heartland knowing that Tom Ridge is on top of this job.
Well, you know, we can joke about it, but living in Washington, I have to hope that he is.
Yeah.
Because my office is literally half a block from the Capitol, and if that last plane, that fourth plane, was heading towards the Capitol, which it might may well have been, it was also heading towards me. So, I really do hope that this is not just bluster, but it's an indication that they have good intelligence and that they're able to do something about it. But, you know, from the outside, it's really hard to tell.
Well, you know, when we started the show, David, before you came on the air, I read the first few sentences of your new book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. And I'd just like to read a few more of the sentences before we go into discussion of the book. The first paragraph concludes as follows. Lying greased George W. Bush's path toward the White House. It has been one of the essential tools of his presidency. To call the 43rd president of the United States a prevaricator is not an exercise of opinion, not an inflammatory talk radio device. The insult is supported by an all-too-extensive record of self-serving falsifications. So constant is his fibbing that a history of his lies offers a close approximation of the history of his presidential tenure. That's a fairly damning statement.
Well, it is. I also have to add, it is not quite representative of the book at large. I mean, I kind of swing my elbows rhetorically a bit at the beginning and the end, but most of the book, of the 300 pages in between, is a I would say it's not that it's dry, but it's a pretty journalistically driven, fact driven analysis or look at or examination of what Bush has said about his policies, his actions, his past, the war in Iraq, Social Security, missile defense, homeland security, tax cuts, energy policy, global warming, and many other subjects, and then comparing what he has said and what he has done to the known record, to the expert testimony, to known facts, and discovering again and again and again that there's a pretty wide gap between what he is telling the public and what the truth actually is.
Yeah, and I should vouch for that, having looked at the book and seen other books of sort of Al Franken and Michael Moore that tend more to really take some rhetorical flourish with the current president. This book is very much a sober book. I mean, it's a good read, don't get me wrong, but it's hardly just sort of throwing brickbats up against the wall.
No, and a lot of the media coverage of my book, I've been lumped in with Al and Michael as ranters on the left, and that's just sort of not what I set out to do, and it's not what I've been doing the last 15, 20 years in journalism, but I can see how, you know, people can't really, to some, it's too fine a distinction to make between a book that has the Michael Moore touch, which accuses the president of lying, and a book that has the David Corn touch, which accuses the president of lying.
Now, what do you say to people before they read the book, before they pick it up, they see the title, and they go, well, gosh, all these guys are liars. I mean, all presidents have been liars.
Right.
Clinton
was
a liar.
Well, that's a natural response, and I get a lot of that. And I kind of deal with that a bit in the introduction, which actually people can get for free at a website called bushlies.com. That's www.bushlies.com, in which I note that previous presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, I'm an equal opportunity bipartisan accuser here, have often abused the truth. But I don't think that the citizenry should wallow in cynicism and just accept it because standards have been defined downward by a string of presidents. And in the case of Bush in particular, I think there are kind of three reasons why one can look at him as being somewhat distinctive in this category. One is that when he ran in 2000, one of his big campaign promises was that he was running for the White House in order to, quote, restore, that's his word, restore honesty and integrity to the Oval Office. So I think it is fair then to judge him by his own standard that he applied. Point number two here is that I do think that, as we're even seeing today with this new increased terror threat warning out there, that while you probably could say at any point in American history we live in dire times, you certainly can say now we live in dire times, and there are real threats and real challenges to be faced. And I think it's really essential to have a president with rock-solid credibility so that he can rally the public and rally the world to do what's necessary to confront these threats and these challenges. As I noted earlier, I do take the threat from al-Qaeda quite seriously, and I want a president who the public can look up to and believe him when he says we need to do this or that in order to deal with the threat. I mean, Bush has said, probably with some justification, that much of the elements of the war on terrorism, which actually I don't like that phrase. It's like calling it the war on sneak attackism. But never, it really should be called the war against the people who did these things to us, if you're going to call it a war at all. But nevertheless, he has said with some justification that parts of the war on terrorism have to be fought in the shadows, covertly, clandestinely. And I understand why, but in essence he's saying, trust us, trust me. And the only way, and if you can't see what he's doing in those shadows, the only way you can determine if he should be trusted, is what he does in other areas, either the overt areas of the war on terror, or what he's doing on global warming and tax cuts or anything else. So his credibility on all these other fronts is tied into his credibility on the essential front of protecting the nation. And then the third and final point I raise when people ask whether he's a different liar or there's any difference between him and past presidents, is that I think it's not controversial to say that the central elements of his presidency are the invasion and occupation of Iraq and the giant tax cuts, which a lot of people have argued, I accept this argument, are tilted towards the rich. These are bold, dramatic policy initiatives. And while I think you could say there were honest arguments for each, that is, honest arguments not necessarily based on made-up facts, arguments that I accept, but with Iraq, you could have argued that he was a repressive, murderous tyrant who needed to be overthrown for humanitarian and human rights reasons with the income tax cuts, the tax cuts. You could, conservatives have argued for years that if you give money to the rich, they spend it, and it helps everybody else. We call that trickle-down. Those are arguments that you can debate back and forth. But what Bush did with each of these bold, dramatic policy measures was to grease them to the hilt with lies and untrue assertions. With tax cuts, he kept saying over and over again that the vast majority of the benefits go to the bottom end of the spectrum. That was not true. And with the war in Iraq, obviously, he kept saying we had to do this now and couldn't wait 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months for increased inspections or more intrusive or aggressive inspections because Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction now, not that he had programs, but possessed them, and had an operational alliance with al-Qaeda through which he could transfer these weapons to al-Qaeda, folks who would surely use them against us if they could. And those things were just not true. So in the key elements of his presidency, he promoted them to the public with a series of untrue assertions that he had reason to know were not true.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580, coming to you from Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, David Korn, the Washington editor of The Nation magazine and the author of the new best-selling book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception, which has just come out, published by Crown Books, it looks like. And if you'd like to call in and ask a question to David Korn, our number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. David Korn's book, your book, David, has 14 chapters, each of which takes on a different lie of George W. Bush. What I'd like to do is talk about a few of those and then discuss specifically how the media has treated George W. Bush in your view. But first of all, chapter one deals with George W. Bush's background, his own story. What are the lies involved with George W. Bush's story of his life prior to becoming president?
Well, there were a lot. I mean, he told lies and made untrue statements about his record as governor of Texas. He kept talking about how he was a tax cutter in Texas, when actually the tax legislation package that he promoted raised taxes. It lowered property taxes, but it raised sales tax, which disproportionately hits low-income people, and it also raised business taxes, which, you know, hits some businesses. But he kept saying on the campaign trail that he had been a tax cutter in Texas. He also said that SAT scores went up in his state during his tenure. This is something that was, like, quite easy to check. You go to, you know, the websites maintained by the Department of Education, you could find, and I found out that actually SAT scores went down in the in Texas while he was governor, while they went up, while the average national average went up during those same years. So there are lots of things about, you know, policy matters during governor, but some of the big ticket items about his past were that I discovered this during the campaign, that in 1978 he had given an interview to a reporter. This is when he was running for Congress, for the Republican nomination for Congress in Texas. And he took a pro-choice position on the question of abortion. And I sort of stumbled across this during the 2000 campaign and was quite stunned because, you know, I had not seen anybody ever write that he had sort of changed his position on abortion. And during the 2000 campaign, you might remember that Al Gore got a fair amount of attention at one point from the media when it turned out that when he was in Congress in the 70s, he had made statements and taken positions that were seen to be anti-abortion, anti-abortion rights. And when I called his campaign to ask about this 1978 interview, they basically just denied it. He said, that's not true. And I said, that's what the paper says. They say, it's not true. I said, I contacted the reporter. That's what she remembered. There was never any correction asked for. And believe me, if you're a reporter and you're covering a race and you get the position of a candidate wrong on abortion, you present it to be the opposite of what it is, you hear from the campaign. People remember these type of mistakes, even if it's that far back.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kept denying, which is, you know, a lie of some sort. And then, of course, there was the issue of his being absent from his National Guard or Air National Guard service during the 70s when he joined the National Guard at the height of the Vietnam War, which more or less ensured that he would not have to go to Vietnam. And there were questions whether strings were pulled again or not, and he kept saying, not to his knowledge, although there were reports in the New York Times and elsewhere that suggested that might have been the case. But nevertheless, he did, for a year while he was in the Guard, according to his own military records, did not report for duty at the base that he was supposed to be, that he was assigned to in Houston. And he came up with a lot of explanations that just didn't hold water and never fully explained that year's absence. And, in fact, during that time period, he was grounded. He had been trained to fly fighter jets, F-102s, I believe, and he was grounded because he failed to take a flight physical during that year when he didn't show up for duty. And he and his campaign said that the reason he didn't take a flight physical was because at that point in time he was living in Alabama, and his personal physician was back in Houston. But as the Air Force or the Air National Guard pointed out, it's not your personal physician who gives you your flight exam, your flight medical exam. It is an Army or not, an Air Force doctor, and you can find them at any Air Force base. So he was grounded. The public had spent a lot of money training him, and then his training went to naught. And he never, you know, explained what happened, and he told a, gave an explanation that was false. And then, of course, another big-ticket item about his past was his DWI charge when he was, you know, found drunk driving in Maine at the age of 30. And he had been asked about, you know, it broke, that story broke days before the election, and it was about a year or, I don't know, I forget, it was a year or the 2 years before that, a reporter from Texas who covered Bush quite regularly asked if he'd ever been arrested as an adult, because he had some arrest in college for stealing a Christmas wreath. But nevertheless, they asked whether he'd been arrested as an adult, and he had said no. So that was a pretty big lie, and his campaign came up with a cockamamie way of spinning that. But even so, in previous interviews, when asked about his record, his past, he kept telling interviewers that there was nothing in his past that he had to be ashamed about. There were no secrets. Everything that was significant in his past was already well known. All these were, you know, disingenuous statements because they ignored this serious DWA arrest of his.
We're talking to David Korn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Korn is the Washington editor of The Nation magazine and the author of the new book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. Our phone lines are open here at Media Matters. The number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is open, which is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Philo, you're on the air with David Korn.
Yeah, thank you. I got a couple of questions. One reason that I called was is that I had read somewhere you were just talking about his National Guard service, and that that Bush is still technically AWOL from the National Guard. Is that true?
I do not think so, because, now in fact, I'm pretty sure that can't be true, because what happened was after he was gone for a year, he then had 3 months of duty in which he pulled a lot of duty. It looked like, you know, from a distance, it looks as if he was trying to make something up very quickly, and then he applied to leave the Guard early so he could go to Harvard Business School, and he was granted early leave. I don't know, you know. Bush has always said that he had no preferential treatment within the Guard, but it's unclear why he got early leave. But it was granted. So I don't believe, you know. So having gone through that officially, I don't understand how he could be considered officially AWOL. It seems as if the National Guard, you know, forgave and forget and forgot what had happened that year he didn't report.
Well, it sounds to me a lot of service people in Iraq would say it sounded like he got preferential treatment.
Well, I think that's a fair assumption, though it's always hard to tell without the full facts.
Yeah, the other comment I wanted to have, I'm going to hang up and listen to what you had to say, is that it seems to me there are a lot of legislative flourishes. The Medicare drug bill is a good example to me where, you know, he's getting a lot of credit for this, but yet I, like with some other things he's done in the past, is it going to get funded? I mean, the next year, I mean, it's 2 years before it even comes into effect. Will they fund it? I mean, there have been other things where he says he's going to do it, and then there isn't any money really for it.
Okay, thank you very much.
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, the biggest example there is the No Child Left Behind Act. Democrats have been making the case that that Bush promised full funding of it when they signed this, a year or so back, almost 2 years ago. And it has not received full funding and is something like $9, $10 billion short this year. I forget exactly what the figure is. Medicare, I think, you know, I'm not the expert on this, but, you know, it's an entitlement. And once you sort of, you know, once it kicks in, the money's supposed to flow. I mean, they've tried to squeeze Medicare over the years on such things as payments to hospitals and doctors and try to, you know, cut down the fees paid. But I think in a situation like this where you've promised to pay X percentage of the drug bills of Medicare enrollees, that you're not going to be able to get out of doing that without, you know, Congress passing another law in order to sort of go back. So I think, and this is that part of the argument that the conservatives had with the bill, is that it would lead to higher entitlement spending. Even so, a lot of Democrats and others thought that the amount of help that this bill provides is minimal. You know, it's, you know, it will be, you know, it'll be significant to some, but for a lot of people, you know, particularly in between, I think, the $2,200 and $6,000 range in terms of how drug cost a year, it doesn't help much there.
We're talking to David Corin, the author of The Lies of George W. Bush and the Washington editor of The Nation magazine. Today in Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple phone lines open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let me tell you, before we go to the next caller, that next week we're going to have one of our classic encore programs. We're going to have a program with Katrina VandenHeuvel, David Corin's boss at The Nation. And in following weeks, we'll have live shows with Doug Rushkoff, Chris Martin, and Paul Krugman. So please stay tuned to Media Matters every Sunday at 1 o'clock here at WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Champagne, you're on the air with David Corin.
Yeah, I guess I have two approaches. But first of all, you did say that you thought Al-Qaeda was a serious threat, which I don't question either. But on the news, it said something about we have these strategic indicators such as Al-Qaeda's desire to attack us. But, okay, put that aside. You're talking about individual lies by one man, but can you talk more about a kind of an apparatus of lying, or, you know, what is the big system behind this in terms of, you know, Cheney and military industrial complex or the Carlyle Group or the neocons or, you know, that kind of thing? I mean, it's not just one, you know, man is not truthful, although I kind of don't think we're ever going to get, you know, I think it's kind of naive not to expect presidents to lie. They do, by definition. But can you talk more about the system rather than the individual man?
Well, in my book, you know, I cover not just what comes out of George Bush's mouth, but also out of Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Ari Fleischer or Scott McClellan and Condi Rice, and others, Colin Powell as well, and Kristen Todd Whitman, Tom Ridge. I mean, the point is to show that the administration as a whole has engaged in deceptive practices to win political and policy debates and to justify falsely actions they're taking, particularly the best example being the war in Iraq. So, you know, there's that. Now, you asked about the apparatus, the machinery, and mentioned Carlyle Group and all these others. It's, you know, I don't think it's, you know, there's a hidden machinery behind all this. It's just that a lot of these, and the neocons and so on, it's just a lot of these folks have all ended up on the same page, sometimes for different reasons. The neocons, for years, have been arguing for the invasion of Iraq. It was, you know, before 9/11 they were doing so, and they weren't, you know, weapons of mass destruction was not the heart of their argument. It was that Saddam Hussein was a, you know, was competition or a threat to U.S. security interests in the region, not a direct threat to Americans back home. And they've been, you know, agitating and advocating war there for a long time. I think after 9/11, for some obvious reasons, it made the job a lot easier for them. And you know, brought Bush closer to their worldview because he wanted to, you know, he looked at Saddam Hussein and wanted to take him out either for family reasons or other. I thought it was probably mostly because of a sheriff's mentality. You know, Al-Qaeda's a hard-to-get target. It's moving. And Bush wanted to be proactive and to be striking out at potential enemies and potential targets. And Saddam Hussein certainly could fit into that, but the Bush administration had to oversell him in order to get public support, oversell the threat, overhype it, to get the public support for the war. And, you know, does this end up helping Halliburton? Yeah, they get these contracts and Bechtel and others, but I doubt that this it's done for that reason. It's, again, it's a congruence of interests come together with this war, as is often the case, and it's not so much that there's sort of a secret committee made up of Halliburton and people in government who sort of plot these things out in order to maximize profits for everybody.
Well, Dale, let's put it in comparison. We're speaking to David Corn again, the author of The Lies of George W. Bush. David Corn, let's put this in perspective. When Bill Clinton, George W. Bush's predecessor, was in the White House for two terms, he was routinely criticized for being a liar. In fact, he was impeached and nearly run out of office for a lie. How would you compare the relationship to the truth of George W. Bush with that of Bill Clinton and their degrees of lying? Or, you know, were they equal liars, or what's your assessment?
Well, you know, to one degree, comparisons are irrelevant because Bush is the president we have now, but I certainly understand the inclination for people to ask for comparisons. I mean, I excoriated Bill Clinton several times for not telling the truth, not so much about the Monica Lewinsky business, which was pretty obvious, and I didn't begrudge conservatives and others, you know, to be outraged at the president for having sex in the Oval Office and lying about it. You know, people can decide what's important to them, and that sort of reckless behavior and untruthful behavior, yeah, I don't think it's wrong to tell anybody. You shouldn't be upset about that. I didn't believe impeachment was the, you know, right course of action. But nevertheless, I can understand why people got mad at him. I would get more upset personally when he would not tell the truth about things such as his policy in Rwanda and genocide, only because I thought those were more public issues and had greater consequences for the rest of the world. Now, if you want to, you know, take the caricature of the two men in terms of their lying and compare Bill Clinton lying about Monica Lewinsky to George Bush not telling the full truth about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, well, one lie, in terms of its impact on others and the rest of the world, was rather small, and another lie in terms of its impact on, and consequences for the rest of the world was rather large. But it's also, I think, you know, because of that difference, it's easier for the press, you know, to focus on Clinton's lie because it was it's harder. The act that it was about is indefensible, and it was not a matter of a policy dispute, and wasn't a matter of in dispute intelligence reports and such. It happened. It was what it was. Clinton said didn't happen. It was sort of a real black and white or blue dress situation. Well, you know, with the war in Iraq, well, I think there's things that, you know, that Bush has said that are, you know, black and white in terms of false or true. They're able to, you know, the advocates of the war in the White House are much able to sort of shift and sift their arguments around and make it look more like a policy dispute rather than an issue of whether the president's telling the truth or not.
Okay, we're talking to David Corn today, the author of The Lies of George W. Bush. If you'd like to call in, our number, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Corn.
Yes, one thing I've been annoyed with is the extreme softball questions that the press has asked George Bush. If you were able to be in part of the press conference, what questions would you ask him?
Well, it's not so much that the questions are softball. It's the way that things are followed up. And if you go to my press conference, if you go to my website, bushlives.com, and look on the left side, you'll see I reference a story I wrote about what happened when I went to a press briefing given by Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, which is a little bit of a different situation than a White House press briefing. But what happens often in both of these situations is a reporter might ask a hard question, and the president kind of, you know, or the press secretary kind of ducks it artfully or inartfully, and then you move on to the next reporter, and he or she is just too intent on asking the question that they've spent a day formulating. And there's not much follow-up, and there's not much, you know, pressure, collective pressure put on the president or the press secretary. Just this past week, Diane Sawyer did an interview with Bush, and if you can go back and read the transcript, and she asked a question. She said, GIs in Iraq are tooling around in Humvees that are not reinforced with armor, and some have asked their parents back home to send them flak jackets. You know, are we, you know, doing everything we can for our troops? And his answer was, yes, we're doing everything we can for our troops. Mm-hmm. And then she sort of moved on to the next subject, where she could have said, wait a second, How can you say that if private citizens have to send flak jackets to GIs? Doesn't that, why is the government not doing that? Why, is it a matter of money? Can you please explain? She just kind of let it go. Now, the question of weapons of mass destruction, she kind of pressed him a little bit harder, saying they haven't been found, and some people thought that you've exaggerated the threat on the case for war, in which Bush kept saying, well, Saddam was a threat. Saddam was a threat. We know that Saddam was a threat. And she kept trying to bring up weapons of mass destruction. And then at one point he said, well, I'm not going to change my answer. And she said something like, well, even David Kaye, says that they weren't weapons of mass destruction there. And Bush said, well, he said there were programs, there were weapons programs. And she said something like, well, you said weapons. He says weapons programs. And Bush then said, well, what's the difference? Well, there's a big difference. And at that point, Diane doesn't say, listen, Mr. President, I really want you to tell me, you said beforehand that there were weapons of mass destruction. Do you believe that was an overstatement for good cause or not, yes or no? And I'm not going to go on to the next subject, which is something like, what he bought Laura for Christmas, until you give me a direct answer. They just don't, zero in that regard. And when I was at the story that I referenced that I wrote, I was at a press briefing at the White House with Scott McClellan, and he said that before 9/11, everybody knew that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And I quoted him a statement from Colin Powell that's up on the State Department website. You don't have to take my word for it. From February 2001, a press conference in which Powell said Saddam Hussein had no significant weapons of mass destruction capability. I quoted the UN saying that, in 98, that they thought they destroyed most of it. I quoted to him the Defense Intelligence Agency report from October 2002 saying they had no hard or reliable data indicating that Saddam Hussein was maintaining or producing chemical weapons. And he said, well, you have your facts wrong. I said, no, I don't. He said, yes, you do. I said, no, I don't. Yes, you do. And it became like a schoolyard argument.
So you just keep denying it, no matter what you're told.
And then no one in the, none of the other reporters, jump in on this and say, well, please, Horn's right or he's not right or, answer the question. And at one point, a reporter was asking about a meeting, a discussion that McClellan said he had with Karl Rove about the leak of the name of Joe Wilson's wife, who was a CI operative. And he refused to give the date when that conversation had. And it was a reasonable question. He raised the conversation himself, so reporters said, when was it? And he kept refusing to give the date. So I just kind of said, I didn't shout and go crazy. I just said, I don't understand. Why don't you just answer the question? Mm-hmm. And I think the whole press corps should have just said, no more questions until you answer that. But they don't. And then at the end of the session, I have to tell you, I don't say this to blow my own horn, but about seven or eight reporters came up to me. None of the big guys from TV who you see on camera a lot, but others from respectable publications came up to me and said, you should come here every day. I felt like saying, well, why don't you just do this every day? It's not too hard. I wasn't being rude or impolite.
Yeah. We're talking to David Corin today, the author of The Lies of George W. Bush and the Washington editor of The Nation. We've got a few lines I want to get to. Let me repeat the numbers for those of you who would like to call in, 333-9455. And our toll-free hunt number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line right now. Dixon, Illinois, you're on the air with David Corin.
Yeah, hello. There's something that I've noticed. It's like you're talking about almost the tip of the iceberg of outright lies. But there's an awful lot of, the linguistic equivalent of creative accounting. It's word finagling, where, for instance, on the Al-Qaeda connection, where that was implied many times, but never quite said outright.
Well, it was at one point, at a November 7th press conference, Bush said Saddam Hussein is dealing with Al-Qaeda. And at that point in time, the CIA publicly put out a statement, noting that there were some contacts in the past between Al-Qaeda folks and Iraqi government officials that they thought they had reports. They hadn't confirmed this stuff. But that was a lot different than dealing.
Let me give you an example.
Bush kept overstating it. again and again and again, just the way that Cheney kept, several times referred to the reported meeting between Mohammed Atta, the 9/11 ringleader, and an Iraqi intelligence official in Prague 5 months before 9/11, even after the CIA and the FBI had more or less debunked the report, which was even further debunked last week. It just didn't happen. But nevertheless, Cheney, when asked about connections between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, would say, well, we do have this report that Mohammed Atta met with Iraqi intelligence officials. Yes, they had a report. They also knew it wasn't true.
Yeah.
She didn't bother telling people. So there were those sort of artful dissimulations
that
came out again and again and again to create an impression. And, listen, I feel bad. The public should be able to trust the president, and they should be able to take cues and impressions from him. And it just shows how people are busy. They don't read the paper. They're getting, they're taking care of their families and doing their jobs. And so if they hear the president say something a few times, I don't expect them to sort of listen to it with the 100% attention and scrutiny that someone like I do, because I get paid to do that. They find very artful ways of putting words next to one another in order to create a very distinct impression that is false, but that serves their interests.
Caller, did you want to have another comment, didn't you?
Yeah, I want to give you an example. This had nothing to do with Bush. I'm not even sure if it would classify as a lie. But here in Illinois, I'm on Medicaid, and I've been taking prescription drugs, which are covered. And one of the drugs I was taking recently, they changed it so it's now over-the-counter. It's no longer prescription. It's no longer covered. Now, if you ask the state, they'll say, well, no, my benefits haven't been cut. But yet, it's finagled. And I think there's a lot of that goes on with Bush, too, where technically it's true, but the effect of it is something else entirely.
Well, I take your point, but often I think that it's not even technically true, although a good example that would fit the technically true standard is when he introduced his last round of tax cuts last January, in which he said something like the average American family gets the American families get an average of $1,093 from these tax cuts. That was mathematically correct, but it was only mathematically correct in that sense, because so much of the tax cuts went to the upper end, the non-average American income earners, that it raised the average mathematically. It raised the figure, though it didn't have any impact on people. It was akin to saying, if there are 10 families on a block, and 9 of them are led by people who are unemployed, and one person in one of those families is making $1 million, you say, this is a great block. The average income on this block is $100,000. It's a technically true statement, but you're saying it to create a false impression. And when a president does that, I think it's fair to call it the functional equivalent of a lie.
David Corn, you've talked about how the press has really laid an egg or dropped the ball and really forcing this administration to come clean. How much of the responsibility here lies with the loyal opposition, the Democratic Party, in not pushing the president as well?
Well, I think a fair bit. And that's because a lot of, you cover this far more than I do, Bob, but, there's often a debate, whether the press is too left, too right. The people on the right think it's too left. People on the left think it's too right. The Washington Press Corps, as far as I can see it, doesn't have a left-right bias as much as a bias towards officialdom. And by that I mean it sort of takes its cues from official Washington. And official Washington is obviously the White House and the president, but it also is Congress. And it prefers to cover issues when there's conflict, more as sporting events, who's going to win the Medicare fight, not what's the better Medicare bill. And if the Democrats are, making, or the opposition party, if it's a Democratic administration, raising a stink about something, and it's being done by the senior people in the party, not by the backbenchers, the people who are marginalized because they're not leaders, the press is going to cover it. The press is going to cover it. If Tom Daschle and Dick Gephardt or Nancy Pelosi came out and said, we believe the president has not told the truth about 9/11, Oh, yeah, that's going to get plenty of coverage. Mm-hmm. Now, will the press look at what the president has said about 9/11 and come to that conclusion on its own? Mostly not. There's a real reluctance to, I think, be seen in the press. I think it's more of a cultural or anthropological issue. There's a reluctance to be seen as being overly accusatory of the president, being out of step with public opinion, not wanting to cross barriers. Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley said in a 97 speech, the hardest thing for the press corps to do is to say the president lied today. But if someone else is out there making a good, strong case, and it's someone who the press has deemed a credible player, then it will indeed get covered. And then, of course, you know, one exception to this, of course, is the tipping point rule, which is, you know, if something, you know, the press, you know, tends to act with a pack mentality, so either everybody's ignoring something or everybody's on top of something. And with Whitewater, Monica Lewinsky, we saw a tipping point was reached in which the press, you know, then sort of all ganged up on Clinton in terms of his credibility. And we saw a little bit almost begin with the Niger controversy back in June and July. And for a couple of weeks, everybody in the press was looking at, you know, Bush statements that were related to the Niger charge or other things close to it and finding instances where Bush might have not told the truth. But it kind of petered out. But one of the best examples I have of this, of this phenomenon of not taking the president on too directly on the credibility issue, is a piece that ran in the Washington Post the day before we went to war in Iraq. This is an op-ed piece. This was written by Dana Milbank, the Washington Post. I think it was Dana Milbank or Mike Allen, one of the two Washington Post correspondents in the White House, who obviously the paper has full faith and confidence in. And the lead sentence was, quote, "As the Bush administration prepares to attack Iraq this week, it is doing so on the basis of a number of allegations against Iraqi President Saddam Hussein that have been challenged, and in some cases disproved by the United Nations, European governments, and even U.S. intelligence reports." The headline above this piece was damning. It said, "Bush clings to dubious allegations about Iraq." So here was the Washington Post the day before war saying that the president was, in essence, guiding the country to war on the basis of dubious allegations or untrue assertions. And what did they do? They put it on page A13. Now, I give the Post credit for doing this piece because I didn't see a similar piece in the New York Times, the LA Times, or the Wall Street Journal. But nevertheless, I sit back and ask myself, or I'd ask the Post, if you believe the president is clinging to dubious allegations that are leading the country into war, why, under what definition, is that not front page news?
Very good question. We're talking to David Korn today on Media Matters. David Korn is the Washington editor of The Nation magazine and the author of the new book, The Lies of George W. Bush. We've got a few people who have been very patient to get on the line with you, David. Let's go to them now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with David Korn.
Hey, good afternoon. Happy holidays to both of you guys. I had a couple of questions. The first is, I'm sort of new to the labor movement, but I'm wondering, in recent presidential elections, has the labor movement been this united against the president, an incumbent president?
Have they been this united against a president?
Right.
And I assume you mean the AFL-CIO.
I'm a member of the NEA, so.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think in the past, I think, you know, when Reagan ran, the labor movement was pretty united in the way it ever, you know, as much as it ever gets, in supporting Mondale, and they, you know, came behind Clinton in 96 and pretty strong behind Gore in 2000, with some exceptions, mainly being the Teamsters, who have always liked to flirt with Republicans. So, but I think, you know, there's a pretty strong consensus now within the labor movement, obviously, that's anti-Bush. The internal debate, obviously, is over who the Democrat can be, and the movement has split, you know, in terms of supporting Dick Gephardt or Howard Dean and, to a lesser extent, John Kerry.
And then my second question is, I guess this isn't a question as much based on lies, but it does seem like like writer David Niewert points out, that the right wing isn't so much about lying as it is just sort of like really vicious eliminationism towards liberals. And it's something that we've witnessed here in town, even with our peace demonstrations, where people have been trying to run down other people, you know, this sort of thing. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, I don't know. I always think it's hard to use these terms, right wing and left wing, in terms of characterizing what they are. On the left, there are, you know, people who have different ideas about life and strategies and tactics. And on the right, too, there's some vicious right wingers, you know, like Rush Limbaugh and others. And there are then there are vigorous right wingers who, you know, argue strongly on policy matters. You know, the people I debate on Fox, like Tony Blankley, who's from the Washington Times and used to work for Newt Gingrich, and Bill Kristol, who edits the Weekly Standard, who used to work for Dan Quayle. I mean, these are not, you know, vicious people in terms of their attacks on the left, but they do like to have strong, you know, policy disputes and fights. And then there are the people like Jerry Falwell, who in the 90s were peddling a video that actually accused Bill Clinton of engaging in murder to bump off his political opponents. I mean, I kid you not, people don't believe this, but he was making TV commercials or on his own TV show promoting this video. And that's just sort of a real, real ugly viciousness. I think it kind of spans the gamut on each side.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. You have a lot of people who want to talk to you. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with David Korn.
I guess what concerns me is the press, from my view, has not taken a look, an in-depth look, at the correlation between Bush's level of funding that he's, for his campaign, his reelection, in other words, the influence of the drug companies. Certainly, my feeling was that when they should have negotiated, in other words, Medicare, they actually negotiate in terms of the hospitals. They put pressure on all that, but, you know, they were given a free hand. The other one is the energy bill. The oil and the, in terms of the atomic energy, they were favored and all that. And environmental, I don't know how true it is, but he's going to be put down as one of the worst presidents in terms of the environment. So, you know, the influence of all these people are sort of happy to give funds because they'd love to get this fellow back in the office again so they can continue on. So would you like to comment on it?
Well, I mean, I think there is some, you know, in the elite mainstream media, the New York Times, Washington Post, there are pieces about the funding that Bush is getting. He's aiming for $200 million. They do cover his fundraisers, and they note who the pioneers are. They may put in, sometimes on the front page, sometimes inside. But, it doesn't get much beyond that. You don't see it talked, tremendously about on TV. But this gets to sort of to an issue that Bob asked about a few minutes ago. One reason I think there's trouble in making, a big story out of this is that the Democrats often, some Democrats try to raise an issue out, make an issue out, and others don't, because the Democratic Party is also collecting money from, if not exactly the same interest, sometimes it is the same interest, but similar interests. So there's, going back to my thesis that it's the media rather covers, a cat fight than to dig into something itself. If the Democrats are not in a position to make a clear argument against Bush on money matters, the media coverage is less than clear.
David, do you think these lies are going to catch up with President Bush in the 2004 election? What's your sense right now?
Now, I'm the guy who wrote the book, The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception, and I have to say, I'm not sure. I think, if we're looking at it strictly in electoral terms, the American voting public, which is different than the American public, but the American voting public, my guess is, tends to be results-oriented. And if they have the sense, rightly or wrongly, that the economy's going okay and that things aren't too bad in Iraq, they won't really focus on what the president said to justify these policies. If indeed things are going off the skids in Iraq in a visual way that's getting media attention here and people are actually absorbing in terms of deaths of American soldiers or mess in Iraq, and if they get the sense that the economy is not producing jobs and there's less economic security, in those instances, then they may go look at what the president told the public in terms of justifying and these policies and selling these policies and saying, wait a second, you hoodwinked us, and hold them accountable then. So it kind of, to a certain degree, depends what the external circumstances are. They're going to be looking mostly at net results, and I think that, if they're positive, they can take an all's well that ends well approach to things, as you saw with the media coverage of the capture of Saddam Hussein, as if that justified the war on the terms that Bush went into Iraq upon.
David, we've only got a couple minutes left, and we have a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Let me go to that caller if I can right now. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with David Korn.
Hi, thanks. Real quick, I agree with 99% of what you said, but my confusion is about the issue of the press being a press of official dumb. While that seems to be true with the Bush administration, it certainly didn't seem to be true back in the Monica Lewinsky days, where it seems like they weren't satisfied just to take the official word and leave it at that. And that leads me to think that there's just a right wing bias. And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Well, I think sex is different. I mean, I think a sex scandal kind of trumps everything and throws all the other.
Well, David, let me interject, because we've only got a minute or two left, because this is a subject that comes up a lot on this show, Media Matters. Beyond the matter of sex, I mean, if you look at the military record of Clinton versus the military record of George W. Bush, or the business practices of Clinton compared to the business practices of George W. Bush, there is an argument that there's been a real different standard of treatment of Clinton that was much more aggressive than there has been with George W. Bush, isn't there?
Well, I think there was to a certain extent, and that, I think, often isn't because of a right-wing bias in the media at large. I think it's probably because there is a more active right-wing media, in the sense that a lot of the stories that you refer to, now while the Whitewater was broken by the New York Times, a lot of it was kept alive and hyperventilated, so to speak, by the Wall Street Journal and conservative talk radio and, conservative groups like Accuracy in the Media. And I think if you do that enough, that eventually it sort of seeps into the mainstream media. They kind of look around, because then the story becomes, how come we're talking about this and you're not? And if you make it part of, that sort of, you can't call it the official agenda, as I used before, but you make it a big enough deal, then they feel a little more inclined to cover it, or otherwise they're accused of being biased. And I do not think the left has the same mechanisms and the same transmission belt there. So it's not necessarily a bias, an ideological bias on part of the mainstream reporters that they, rather attack a president who's on the left than the president on the right. I
David
think that's more to do with the media universe.
I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters. David Korn is the Washington editor of The Nation, the author of the new book, The Lies of George W. Bush. Thanks for being our guest today. Next week, we've got an encore show with Katrina Vandenhoevel, then back with live shows thereon after. Happy New Year, everyone.
Mondays through Thursdays at 3 in December, AM 580 presents Gray Matters. Tomorrow's program is the teenage brain. Brain researchers are finding physiological evidence for something parents of adolescents have long suspected. Teenagers just don't think or feel the same way adults do. This riveting review of the research documents that the disparities are real and due in part to the fact that teenage brains actually work differently from adults. That's the teenage brain on Gray Matters tomorrow afternoon at 3 Central Time here on AM 580 WILL Urbana. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny and warmer with a high in the mid-40s and south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy and warmer with a low in the mid-30s and southwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain, the high in the upper 40s with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's